And I would give Proctor credit for throwing you in a little before you're ready and probably standing on the side of the pool with a life preserver, but you can't see them. You don't know they're there.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Beyond High Street. David Schwab here. Pretty psyched. Today is our 10th pod. Just starting out here, but we've got a lot more in the queue. Really appreciate everyone listening and sharing with friends and other Miamians. Today we chat with luxury garage sale CEO Trish Lukasik about her business path, how she learns, how she grows, how she thinks, and what Miami meant to her. She even breaks into a little French for us. That's the first on our pod. She is definitely a self-progressed numbers nerd who started in finance, but then dabbled in every single department in her business career just to get those tools needed to where she is now. She definitely was thinking in advance. Interesting to hear her perspective on that. It's also the first time I've ever talked to somebody who thanked a company for teaching them how to be a good employee. She does that talking about her days at Proctor. We started the conversation with a little Miami rapid fire. Bring us back to Oxford. All right, so back to High Street. What freshman dorm?
Emerson.
Emerson, I was in Anderson. And your favorite place to live on campus?
Well, that had to be the house I lived in junior and senior year, which was around the corner, 100 East Collins.
I do love all the names on all the houses, though I'm not sure on the pod we could say most of those names.
but so you could say ours around the corner, no
yes,
problem.
That one works. That one works. Sorority?
Tried out.
Favorite teacher or class?
Economics. And, oh my God, I'm going to have to Google him. Oh, crud.
Freshman, sophomore, junior, senior?
It was junior and senior because economics was became my dual major because of these two guys. And Richard Hart will be ticked at me that I don't say him, but that wasn't really him.
Was it the major itself or a particular class?
I loved all of it. I was a big fat economics geek. I loved that four-color pen and the blue book and all that nonsense. But I loved like econometrics, which I thought was like really hard. And I can't believe I can't remember his name. I can picture him perfectly.
All right, we're going to come back. You'll remember before we finish.
Okay.
What about clubs and intramurals? Besides going uptown and some classes.
Wait, was there anything else other than that? Sorry. That was pretty much my deal.
Yeah.
Sorority life and uptown life. That was really what I did, to be honest, which is sort of shameful.
Yeah. No, that's what we that is what we did. Did you go to Lux?
I did go to Lux.
When did you go to Lux?
I went to Lux junior summer after my junior year.
Okay. Miami merger?
Not a Miami merger.
All right. What about curly fries or crisp cut at Skipper's?
Curly.
Mm-hmm. other favorite restaurant or bar uptown?
Okay. Do you remember there was a Mexican restaurant? It was like in the corner behind the water tower.
I'm going to say it was called Pedro's.
It was called Pedro's. And their shrimp nachos, which was like a joke. They weren't real shrimp, I'm sure, and they weren't real. But anyway, their shrimp nachos were like a delicacy.
That's awesome. All right. When was the last time you were back on campus?
Oh, my gosh. I was just back like in November.
And what were you back for in November?
So I just recently joined the Business Advisory Council. And I went down to chat with them a bunch of students and a couple of different round tables, and then had my son, who's a junior, get a tour of the business school and all that good stuff, go to take in a hockey game. It was great. It was super fun.
And tell me a little bit more about the Business Advisory Council.
I wish I could. But it is a group of us who apparently meet sort of like a board once a quarter and review sort of what's happening at the business school, what the future looks like, the curriculum, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I have my first official meeting April 9th.
Awesome. Did you?
Which I'm very excited about.
Did you grow up in Ohio?
I grew up in Cleveland, and I admit it.
That's good. And did you always want to go to Miami? Was Miami number one, or why Miami?
I totally didn't want to go to Miami. I said I wasn't going to Miami. Like, I made a big, bold statement, like, I will never go to this school. My brother is 2 years older than I, and he was there. And then two things happened. The first is I went down to visit him for a little Sibs weekend, and that's probably about all I need to say.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as luck would have it, it turned out that I got to go to Miami for free, and that was pretty amazing as well. And my parents didn't actually tell me that story. I found the letter hidden in our house, and I was very compelled to read that letter. And then, like, I grew up in a family where it's not that that had to happen, but it certainly didn't hurt.
That's awesome. And did you, was the econ, the geek perspective, as you said it, was that always in the brain, or did you develop that after a couple years at Miami?
No, so I was going to Miami as a finance major. I have always been a numbers nerd, for sure. You know, I was that kid who, like, rode my bike up and down the street and, like, saw people's addresses and played with the numbers in my head to see if I could get them to do something interesting. still am, by the way. but when I started taking econ classes, I fell in love with econ and with sort of the science of understanding consumers, which I guess ended up parlaying into my career for a really long time. But truly, it was Dr. Richard Hart who was like, well, just do both then. Don't give up your – because he wanted me to do an econ degree, and I was like, I don't think I can get a job with an econ degree. Like, what am I going to be? I want to be chairman of the Fed. That job seems to be full, and there's a few folks in line for it. And so he convinced me to do both, to have a dual degree, and so I did.
And do you still want to be chairman of the Fed?
Totally. Oh, my God, completely.
There's time. There's time for that. Now, is it true also a French minor?
Vraiment, c'est vrai. Je parle français tout le temps. Yes, it was true.
And where does that come from?
Okay, quick story. So I'm kind of a competitive person, and my brother, who I already alluded to, is 2 years older, and I have a lot of family from France. And a woman I called my aunt, who is really like my second cousin, was at our house for Thanksgiving 1 year. She's quite a bit older than us, and my brother and she exchanged like 4 words, like "donnez-moi la beurre" at Thanksgiving dinner or something. And I thought it was so ridiculously obnoxious and exclusive to not include the whole family in their rapport. And so my aunt said if I learned the language, she would take me to France. And there you go. I learned the language in my junior year of high school. I spent the summer in France with family.
I have
loved it ever since.
I'm going to have to turn this into a bilingual pod. I'm going to have to... I've got some work ahead of me then.
Okay, good. But you'll have to understand that I will probably occasionally say things like "I is running." And as long as we're good with that, the conjugation may not be quite right. But other than that, I'm all good.
All right. So you left Miami and went, I think, like a lot of people, just down the street to P&G.
Indeed. And I said, again, I would never do that. My life was like full of "I would never," big, bold "I'd never" statements, which all of which I've had to take back. So I said I would never go to Procter because I thought they were like all over campus from the day you arrived. And, you know, at the time, John Smale was CEO and an alum, and it was just, you know, it was really there, right? And then 2 things happened. The first is they brought a couple of us down for junior day. I don't know, probably a dozen or so for junior day, junior year, and put us up in the Westin that night. And I thought I had like struck pay dirt. I was like, oh my God, they have robes in the closet, right? I really remember calling my mom and telling her that. That's embarrassing, but true. And then they came back to campus and put on this big show about how they would probably not hire any of us and blah, blah, blah. And I thought that was like a compelling, competitive thing. And I wanted to see what happened. And so I went to work for Procter, and probably the smartest decision I ever made.
Yeah, I mean, just if I look at your whole summary, it's like go big business, learn from the experts at Procter and Coke and PepsiCo, then work your way into startup venture type space and take all that experience together and now lead a business with all of that experience. It's kind of, that's what it looks like 30,000 feet down. So go back.
That is a remarkably fair assessment.
So what was it at Procter and then I guess at Coke and PepsiCo working at big business that really gave you the roots?
So for sure, I would give Procter credit first, but not exclusively. But what I found to be so incredibly helpful about starting at P&G is P&G teaches you how to be an employee. And I didn't know that. You come out of undergrad thinking you know a lot of things, and you do, but I didn't really know how to work, right? And the discipline and the rigor and the analytics and the ownership and the process that goes with running a business. And I learned all those things at P&G. And I would give Proctor credit for throwing you in a little before you're ready and probably standing on the side of the pool with a life preserver, but you can't see them. You don't know they're there. So I started managing my first group of people when I was like 26 years old. I had no business managing that group, that team. God love them for being gracious enough to let me learn on their time. But, you know, you make a lot of mistakes, but the mistakes aren't catastrophic yet. So I learned a lot of things there, and I really appreciated all that the opportunity I was given to learn those things. Through the rest of the journey at Coke and PepsiCo, then you can apply all of that, but then expand, right? One of the things that Miami taught me for sure is you can never stop learning, and you should never stop learning. And so my whole career in big business, I would say, was really defined by this desire to keep learning. And so I took the jobs that no one else wanted to. Mm. I often called myself the Mikey of PepsiCo. I don't know if you remember those life ads. Most people don't now anymore, right? But, but those life ads, I was that person who said, yeah, I'll try that, which I would love to pretend was super strategic and thought out, but that would be a flat out lie. What it really was opportunistic. And I got to try a whole bunch of other things and learn a whole bunch of other things that I probably wouldn't have gotten to do. So I worked in operations and I worked in sales and I was a general manager and I expanded outside of finance and economics because I got to keep learning at those other places. And that was amazing. And I think that actually really wonderfully set me up for startup world. I just didn't know it at the time.
What was one of those opportunistic jobs that you took that you realized, I don't want to do that, or that's not where I'm going to spend the next 25 years?
I don't know if I had that as much as I had, oh, wow, I tried this crazy job. That was amazing. Now I want to try another one because I don't want to say bored or mastered it, but more like that was fun. I want to do it again. I don't want to stay stuck here. Mm-hmm. I don't think I had one that I said, that I really, really said, I don't want to do this job.
And how much did you see big business change from when you started at Procter to when you left PepsiCo almost 15 years later?
Yeah, a ton. I mean, a ton. I felt like, particularly when I joined PepsiCo, PepsiCo is much more of an ambitious culture, much more competitive, very transparent with those results, right? Racked and stacked results were posted every week. You knew where you stood. And more entrepreneurial. Proctor had rules. There were certain ways to do things. When I joined PepsiCo, it wasn't quite the case as much. And so I felt like being able to have impact and being able to make decisions on the business, I felt that. I really felt it even at a pretty junior level. And over time, I felt that become, you know, a bit more controlled. And I talked about this at PepsiCo often, so it wouldn't be out of turn for me to talk about it now. I remember very early in my time at PepsiCo, my boss coming in and saying, hey, I don't have time to look at this today. So we have this $100,000 deal with customer X. I need you to take a look at it and decide whether we should do it or not. Whatever you decide is fine, but just decide this morning and let them know. And I mean, I was probably 4 weeks into my tenure at PepsiCo and I was like, oh my God, I'm wholly unequipped to answer this question. Right. And in the big scheme of things, it was $100,000 decision. Many years later, when I was a chief customer officer and a senior vice president there, I felt like I had the ability to make even fewer decisions on that. And that's just big business slowing you down. Right. And that was very frustrating.
Chief customer officer, not something you normally hear from a, numbers
nerd.
That's a change just there.
Yeah, totally. excuse me. I remember when I first was going to take a sales role, and for a lot of my life, when people heard I worked for a big CPG company, people always asked me, oh, you're in sales or marketing. I was like, no, I'm finance. I'm like, no, you're not. And I was like, no, really, I am. And so I always sort of felt like maybe I had some sort of misfit that I didn't realize yet. That's actually completely true, by the way. But, you know, I had this moment of like self-doubt. Anyway, I was finally tapped to go run a customer team for PepsiCo. And what I did realize later for sure is that no sane salesperson wanted that job. It was a really challenging customer. And every logical person turned it down, which is why they came to me. I was very flattered at the time, by the way. Then later I realized, oh, I get it.
Here comes Mikey again. Yep.
Yeah, here comes Mikey. But But I vividly remember, I would tell you the phone number because I already told you my number's in there, but then I would give away which customer it was. I vividly remember the first, it was a Friday afternoon around 3 o'clock, and my phone ringing, it being that customer and seeing that number pop up on my phone. I'll tell you the last four digits were 8248. And I was in a sheer panic. I was like, oh my God, like, what if they yell at me? I don't know what I'm supposed to say. I've never really worked with a customer directly. Anyway, I picked up the phone because I didn't really have an option. And in fact, he did yell at me, that person. He was very angry about something. And I'm happy to tell you that today I'm still in touch with that person. He's a great friend. He's been a good mentor to me. But I learned a lot, right? I learned a lot about the reality of all of us just have certain incentives or certain tasks that we're asked to complete as part of our job responsibilities. And if you understand what those are, then it becomes much easier. It's like having the answer key to the job. You know what you're going to go work on because the customer's already told you the answers. You just have to go work on them, right? And this doesn't always make it easy, but you at least know where you're headed, right?
Makes a lot of sense. All right, so now we've done that. We've solved all the customer concerns out there at PepsiCo, and it's time to go off to try a parking reservation service.
Yeah, doesn't that make complete and utter sense to you?
Yeah, I don't. There probably aren't that many that went Procter, Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Spot Hero.
Right. And all of my colleagues at PepsiCo, by the way, were like, have you lost your mind? Right. But here's the thing. I sat down and I thought about, like, in this next chapter, what do I want? What do I want that will keep me as energized as all those different moves across functions and across businesses over time? What will keep me revved up like that? Because I'm not ready to sort of sign up for the straight path to retirement. Like, that's just not how I'm wired. I don't judge that, but it's just not who I am. And I had four criteria. My four criteria were very simply, I wanted a customer-facing, consumer-facing business. I'd spent my whole life solving consumer problems, and I really enjoy that. Second was, I really wanted startup tech because I didn't feel like that was coming. I felt like that was here. I think it's actually going to continue to really impact the way that people think about work and the types of companies people choose to join. So I wanted to see if I could go from that 300,000 global personal organization to the 101 and transfer capabilities and knowledge and leadership or not. Like, it was an experiment, and I thought it'd be interesting. It may happen to be my life, but it was also an experiment. Third, I really wanted a role that brought together all those diverse things I had done. So instead of doing them discontinuously, I wanted to do them simultaneously, finance and sales and marketing and operations, and see what happened. And fourth, I really wanted to stay in Chicago. We had moved quite a bit through my career at PepsiCo. I had kids who were getting close to entering high school, and I felt like it was time that somebody else's agenda had to come before mine. And through a very serendipitous networking event, which had no intentionality, and I like to tell the story because I think sometimes people think about networking as like, ugh, right? This was not an ick event. A friend of mine who I know through the Aspen Institute called and said, I'm doing this event out in Silicon Valley, and I wonder if you'd come and speak at it. And I sort of spit my water out laughing because I was like, I get it. You have all like your fast-paced tech friends. And then you went through your whole mental Rolodex and were like, I know. Who do I know who's a lifer at a big company? It's Trish, right? And so you called me to see if I'd come and play the role. So I wore like a navy blue suit. This is a true story. I dressed the part. I was all ready for the role I was supposed to play. Anyway, in preparing for that event, the gentleman who was leading it for LinkedIn was actually a Chicago-based executive, and my office were a block away. And we just sort of said we should keep in touch. That was interesting, working together, et cetera. We did. He happened to be on the board of Spot Hero and was an early investor in Spot Hero. And, you know, the rest is history. Right?
Yeah, I feel like networking, it is much more about the conversations that you have and the friend of the friend or the shared passion or, in this case, geography that ends up leading somewhere.
Yeah, right? It was just it was crazy. It was great. I probably, had it not been a connection to me that was that close, I probably wouldn't have made that kind of a jump, honestly, right? But yeah, I had somebody who I trusted and who I respected who said, this would be super interesting. You know, you could have big impact. You should go. And I did, and it was amazing. Really crazy transition, but they taught me startup, and I'm so eternally grateful to that entire team and that board for giving me the chance to try, because a lot of people wouldn't have taken a me into that context, right?
Yeah, I was in Los Angeles 2 weeks ago at the NBA, the basketball All-Star game, and they do a technology summit, and I bet 80% of the people in the room were startup VCs, and 20% were big business, which was a complete role reversal from where it was a year ago or 2 years ago.
It's right.
The startup tech space is, as you said, it's certainly here and not going anywhere.
It's so interesting. And so I remember walking into like my first event as a part of the Spot Hero team. It was like the day I joined the company, literally. And I got home and my husband asked me like, well, how was it? I'm like, it was humbling. Because I'd been in the consumer packaged goods industry for so long, I could walk into any major event and I would know a good deal of people and feel very comfortable there. And all of a sudden, all these years into my career, I walk into this tech startup event in Chicago and everyone knew everyone and I was the odd girl out. And it was amazing. But then I roll the cameras forward to today, a year and a half later, and I have a whole new ecosystem that I get to operate in and get to, you know, meet and expand my own network. And it's amazing. It's really fun.
But then we went over. Now we've got a luxury garage sale CEO role. I mean, we're jumping, but we're jumping to a place now where you've put all of these skill sets and experience and learnings together to run a business.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I know there's a bunch of studies out there, recent studies that have looked at female CEOs and like in the Fortune 1000, and the data suggests that very, very few of them ever aspired to be a CEO, that they got there through mentorship and through personal initiative, but it wasn't their aspiration. I would tell you around 2010, probably, maybe a little later, 2011, is when I first started to say, you know what, I think I do want to be a CEO one day. And that wasn't meant to be arrogant or outrageous. It was more meant to be like, can I put these different things together that I've done into a mosaic that makes sense, that like has a pattern to it at some point? And that was largely driven by that crowd for the Aspen Institute. I was so fortunate to be part of that fellowship. And a lot of my peers there, a lot of my people in my class were like, why don't you do this? Why don't you try that? And I hadn't really thought about it before, honestly, like in a structured way, in a really reflective way. And so that's when it first dawned on me, like, I think I do want to try that one day. And then once that became clear, two things happened. First, I tried to take moves that clearly allowed me to lead down that path. That didn't mean that was going to be the foregone conclusion, but it meant that I was going to do things that intentionally prepared me to be able to be in that position, so that if it didn't happen, I didn't look back with regret and say, well, I just didn't take that risk, or I just didn't take that chance. The second thing is I started to talk about it out loud, which was very, very scary. But I felt like I couldn't aspire to that if I wasn't willing to tell people that that was my goal. And it was astounding to me how many voices of support came out once you started telling people. And that was awesome, actually.
And where is the business? Domestic, international?
We sell both today. It is heavily skewed toward domestic, and I think it will continue to stay skewed toward domestic, because there's a couple of really tricky things that, like, who knew when you get into fashion about some things that you can't export, like fur, et cetera. So there's some barriers that make it a little more complicated. Again, we do sell outside of the U.S. today, but the majority of the business is within North America anyway. And I think we'll stay that way for the next 2 to 3 years, give or take, maybe two. And the majority of the business today is focused on female. So our shopper and our inventory is highly cultivated and curated toward the female consumer. Hold on, gentlemen, because I think in 2019, you'll see us start to explore other areas. There's a good deal of interest from men today. 20% of our web traffic is men searching for men. So we want to meet that need. We're just not ready to quite yet.
And what is your perspective in the buying product online era of brick and mortar stores?
Yeah, so we have both, which makes us interesting, right? A lot of folks would encourage us, a lot of investors even that I've talked to are like, well, don't you want to get out of the retail stores? And our retail stores are actually really productive for us. They do two things. They help us gather inventory because we have a lot of consigners who drop their inventory with us through our stores. And then, of course, once they're there, they may actually choose to shop as well, which, I mean, who are we to say no to that? But in addition to that, we build a lot of really deep relationships through our stores. We host a lot of events at our stores. So, for example, we're doing something with the Chicago Costume Council later this week at one of our stores in celebration of the Oscars, and we'll be putting on different looks with the Costume Council that we open up to friends and family of, you know, and current clients of ours to get a sneak peek at different pieces of inventory, et cetera. Those things are really fun. But our stores are growing. Our brick-and-mortar stores are growing. They're growing healthily, and we're really quite happy to have that outlet because it does something different for us than our e-commerce model does. We encourage and expect our offline shoppers to convert to online shoppers, and they do. But many people still like the idea of having a stylist style them. They still like the idea of having that personal action, being able to try something on, being able to touch it first. And that's okay with us. So right now we have both pieces of the business. I think we will continue to have brick and mortar and a strong e-commerce presence. And I think, is the e-commerce side growing slightly faster than the brick and mortar side? It is, but they're both delivering growth today, and that makes me happy.
Early in the conversation, you said one thing that Miami helped was teaching to learn and always to learn. Now as a CEO, how do you learn? Where do you get the inspiration from now?
Oh, many places. So I listen to lots of podcasts. No, that wasn't a shameless plug. That's actually
true. Thank you.
I have a pretty long commute, and so it's a really productive way to use my time. I sit on a couple boards, and that is also really informative because you get to see business from a different angle then and think about, you know, how might my board react to this thing or that thing, or how might I be thinking about it if I were sitting in a different seat. I think that's very, very valuable. I read a lot. I will be really honest. I don't always read sort of business or, you know, leadership books cover to cover because I just can't. But I do read. I selectively pick out the pieces and the chapters of something that I'm really interested in engaging on. And then I constantly work to grow my network, like constantly. And I don't mean that in like a shameless, schmoozy way. I mean, I have a philosophy of lead with yes, which does not mean that I don't say that I don't ever use the word no. I do indeed. But if I can make an event, if I can attend the panel, if I can have the breakfast, I will say yes, because it ultimately leads you to different ways of thinking, different experiences. And through that, I think you continue to learn all the time.
Wow. I could talk to Trish forever. She is incredibly engaging. You can just hear the excitement in her voice and that craving to learn. Fired me up. I'd run through a wall for her if I worked for her. And even as a CEO, she still has that daily appetite to learn. I actually believe her. She may be Fed Chair one day. I'll come back to Oxford when she delivers the commencement as Fed Chair. Trish also called immediately after we were done to say the professor's name was Tom Hall. Again, thanks you guys for listening to this pod. This is a labor of love. We're having a ton of fun. I appreciate the follows on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn, and sharing ideas and emails. We're getting a lot of great guest ideas. Keep them coming so we can keep this pod going for a long time to help out all Miamians. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you at Skipper's. And don't forget, when you go, try some of Trish's favorite curly fries and tell Andy I said hi.